It is Monday, October the 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Macedonians turn out in low numbers for a name change referendum.
We can't really put it down to matters of apathy. There's been genuine resistance towards having to change the name to Republic of North Macedonia.
Tsunami warning issues in Indonesia, plus investigating allegations against a U.S. High Court nominee.
In the traditional sense of what an investigation should look like, this is certainly not what it looks like, and it certainly doesn't give the FBI the latitude that they need.
Also ahead, tech for the disabled, plus remembering a worldwide known music legend. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Macedonian Prime Minister Zoran Zaev cast his ballot on Sunday in the country's referendum on whether to accept a landmark deal ending a dispute with Greece by changing the country's name to North Macedonia. Speaking after voting, Zaev said he was confident of a strong voter turnout that would prove Macedonians are in favor of joining NATO and eventually the European Union. The turnout ended up being low, and about a third of the eligible voters actually went to the polls. Zaev has pledged now to press on with a vote in Parliament despite failing to secure the 50% turnout a referendum requires. VOA's Victor Beatty asked RMIT University senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies, Benoy Kampmark, if this is a setback for Macedonia.
Yes, it is a very big setback because, of course, the Zaev administration is banking a lot on making sure that this deal of changing the name to pacify the Greek element, the deal with Tsipras that was made in June, to enable them to join NATO and to join the European Union. So that would be part of the broader arrangements that would bring them into the European fold far more effectively. And this is something that Zaev wants to press on, and of course it would have been appropriate had they received the full backing from the referendum, but it doesn't seem, as we can see, they've actually gotten the necessary 50% no vote required for this.
Was this the result of apathy or real opposition to this referendum?
Oh, there was genuine opposition. There was a lot of disagreement within various political parties and certainly an active campaign from opponents to boycott the actual turnout. So of those that have turned out, they've overwhelmingly voted, actually, for the name change, but a conspicuous number have not. So we can't really put it down just to matters of apathy. There's been genuine resistance towards having to change the name to Republic of North Macedonia. You know, people are resentful as well because they have to do this and question whether it's the birthright issue and all of that. So there are significant plays there. So.
Well, why are they opposed to it?
It's one of those things where the Greek governments, successive governments, have always said that they're not entitled to call themselves Macedonian or Macedonia. So, that, of course, they've been called the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And for them, it is very much a case of identity as well. So they've refused to also consider themselves by that name. So they'd like to be known as Macedonia as well. But, of course, this is considered an affront to the Macedonian territory in Greece. So this is a clash of identities and an issue of name, but also an issue of prestige as well. So that's something that's very important.
Did Russia have interest in making sure this referendum did not pass?
It has been said that there have been cyber attacks and interference from Russian sources, and there is a suggestion that the Russian embassy in Skopje has been a hotbed of intelligence activity leading up to the particular referendum. It's very clear, of course, from the Russian perspective that having Macedonia move into the NATO and EU fold is not necessarily in its interest. So that's one of the prospects that have made Russian involvement a genuine issue.
Failing the 50% necessary vote for this, even though there was overwhelming support among those who did cast ballots, what happens now in Parliament? Will Mr. Zaev be able to gather the two-thirds necessary to pass this?
And that really is dependent on whether parliamentarians feel that there is credibility in the vote that doesn't make the 50% threshold. Because it doesn't make that, it's of course a non-binding outcome, and it means that parliamentarians are perfectly entitled to, of course, not go through with it. So it's all dependent on how Mr. Zaev actually manages to convince fellow parliamentarians, the 120 members, as it were, with how credible it is to go through with this deal, because it is very clear the president, for example, is very much against the change of name. So he's got opposition from the president, and he's got opposition from various political parties of Parliament. So it'll be very interesting to see how the cards fall on this one.
Binoy Kammark is a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies at Australia's RMIT University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Indonesian officials say they fear the death toll from Friday's earthquakes and tsunami could go well above the more than 830 confirmed deaths so far in the area of Sulawesi Island, where the tsunami came on shore. AP correspondent Margie Mason reports the tsunami was powerful and deadly, leaving residents little time to escape.
You had the tsunami, which in some areas reached up as high as 6 meters or 20 feet. And the wall of water was coming at a very, very high rate of speed. So anybody who did not take cover and run inland or get up in a sturdy structure up high, they would have been swept away by the wall of water.
The installation of an early warning system that might have prevented some deaths in that tsunami was stalled in the testing phase for years. For some reaction, VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaks with Louise Comfort, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School, who is the principal investigator for the U.S. National Science Foundation regarding early tsunami detection in Indonesia. She talks here about the early warning system not being in place.
This is particularly painful for me because the tsunami early detection system we have been working on for 5 years now, actually going back to the 2004 tsunami, is in its prototype stage, and just last week we were told it was put on hold. This is a system that relies on ocean bottom units on the ocean floor that pick up the movement of the water, changes in the water column that indicate a tsunami. This method of detection is much more accurate and more timely than the system that was available, you know, in the last few days. Unfortunately, the Indonesians had to rely on the land-based seismic sensor system, which indicated the earthquake, but they had only the GPS observational units, or I'm not even certain they had GPS units in Palu, tide gauges, which are basically observation of movement of the water. So they did not have the information they needed to make a decision and to recognize that the tsunami was coming in Palu.
As far as you know, why was it placed on hold?
Regrettably, as far as I know, and it's hard to say, there was a devaluation of the Indonesian currency this summer, and the finance ministry had allocated the funds for this prototype. But in the allocation, the devaluation made less money available. So BBBT, the Marine Survey Agency, was worried about starting the deployment of the prototype and not having sufficient funds to complete it.
How much money was Indonesia expected to put up for this?
Well, the overall amount was about $150,000, and the amount of that was allocated was just under $100,000. So what BPPT was worried about with the devaluation of the currency was about $50,000.
What would have happened had the system been up and running?
Had the system been up and running, they would have picked up immediately from the ocean floor the change in the water column, and that would have been transmitted via acoustic communication to the shore station and transmitted to BMKG. What was missing for BMKG, and the reason they pulled back the warning, is they had no direct measurement of changes in the water column.
How do you feel about this? Are you angry? Are you upset? How do you feel about this?
I am profoundly disappointed, because we have the technology. We have also Indonesian researchers who have been working valiantly for 10 years trying to get a system like this in place. And the difficulty is no single agency or researcher can do it alone. It requires a collaborative commitment to solve this problem of early tsunami detection.
University of Pittsburgh Graduate School Professor Louise Comfort, who is the principal investigator for the U.S. National Science Foundation regarding early tsunami detection in Indonesia. She was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Now we shift to a story which has virtually dominated U.S. news for a while, the confirmation hearing for President Trump's nominee to be the next justice of the Supreme Court. In recent days, Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation has been delayed as several people have come forward to accuse him of sexual misconduct. Christine Blasey Ford spoke before a Senate panel last week testifying that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were in high school. Another woman says he exposed himself to her in college. Kavanaugh denies all those allegations. Meantime, others have corroborated stories of his heavy drinking and alleged salacious behavior, while lawmakers, the president, and others continue to maintain Brett Kavanaugh is the man for the job. VOA's Lori London speaks with Angela Reddick Wright, an attorney and investigator with the Los Angeles-based Reddick Law Group. She investigates sexual misconduct and harassment for private and public companies and talks here about an FBI investigation President Trump has ordered.
Well, it certainly will not be a thorough investigation or background check, just by virtue of the fact that the Senate and the White House have limited, one, the time that the FBI has to conduct the investigation, two, who they can speak to, and then three, this broad concept of only investigating relevant allegations or credible allegations. Well, who's determined what allegations are credible or not, and whether the allegations are credible or not, after interviewing even one witness, those allegations could lead to other information or evidence to create additional allegations or to support the allegations or raise additional questions about the allegations. So in the traditional sense of what an investigation should look like, this is certainly not what it looks like, and it certainly doesn't give the FBI the latitude that they need to conduct a true, complete, thorough, and full investigation.
Is it still possible that they could get to some truths and uncover some things enough to sort of make sense of all of this?
Of course. I understand today that they spoke to one of the other women that complained against Kavanaugh. I understand that Mr. Judge is supposed to speak with them later this week. So I'm sure through those interviews that they will gather additional relevant information. But we don't know if that's all the information. Ms. Ford, she testified that there was a party. There were numerous individuals present at the party, at least four to five from the incident, specific incident that she's alleging. And now we've heard stories of Kavanaugh and his character in high school still, and also in college, and on some extent since college. So there's arguably lots of witnesses out there, lots of information out there that would be relevant, not just to Ms. Ford's claim, but really whether Mr. Kavanaugh is fit to serve as a Supreme Court justice.
The stories are so differing. Dr. Blasey Ford, who many, even of the Republican senators, said she seemed very credible, but yet they seem to choose sides. They seem to to be more inclined to praise Judge Kavanaugh and almost seemed sympathetic to what he had been going through with the accusations. If she was credible, how can both stories be true?
Well, that's the conundrum here, right? I think what we have going on more so is politics. And while certain senators acknowledge that they believe there's some validity to Ms. Ford, Dr. Ford's story, but they excuse it by saying it's clear that something happened to her, but we don't necessarily believe that it happened by Mr. Kavanaugh, or just by virtue of the fact that she's come forward so many years later, that they're almost dismissing it as not mattering, even if they do believe on some level, although they would never admit it, that Mr. Kavanaugh possibly engaged in some inappropriate conduct towards Ms. Ford. So that's the conundrum here, and is what makes this entire situation difficult, that some very serious claims have come forward, yet our Senate, yet our White House is pushing the nomination forward despite the information that they're hearing.
Angela Reddick Wright is an attorney and investigator with the Los Angeles-based Reddick Law Firm. She was speaking with VOA's Lori London. New technologies are helping people who are disabled with physical as well as cognitive vision and hearing problems, and some promising new tools include a digital glove that translates sign language and tactile windows for people who are blind. We get more now from VOA's Deborah Block.
Inventor Halil Ayoub slips a black glove onto her hand before beginning the familiar swish of sign language. She pushes a button on her wrist, and a small speaker relays the message.
This glove translates sign language into speech to help people who cannot speak.
Ayoub is the inventor of BrightSign.
I am tired.
My dream for BrightSign is to be the extension of the senses for the people who want that kind of technology, who want to voice their feelings and opinions without having to always look for someone to help them out, to give them the independence that they need and the control over their own communication.
She estimates each pair of gloves will cost a few $100s and explains how they work.
So this is called a data glove, which is wired with multiple sensors to track the hand movements. And there are sensors that measure how much your fingers are flexed and bent. And there are sensors here that measure exactly where your hand is in 3D space. And that information is being transferred to a computer chip right here. And once I make a sign language sign, basically I press this button and it translates all of those movements into words that are spoken out through the speaker.
There are also new devices to help the blind. The Ford Motor Company worked with an Italian startup to create a device that helps blind people feel the view outside a car window by turning light into vibrations that, when combined with an audio description, conveys a sense of the scenery passing by.
Own solution.
Last year, Microsoft launched its free Seeing L app, which turns a smartphone into a talking camera.
Meet me at Starbucks.
Paul Beppi, who is blind and lives alone, uses the Seeing L app to do things like finding food and drinks.
You've got the empowerment and independence literally in your pocket on your smart device.
Analysts say demand for technology that augments our ability to see and hear the world around us can only grow. Deborah Block, VOA News.
And still ahead, events on this day in history. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international group of scientists has identified a new giant plant-eating dinosaur species in South Africa. The team's research and findings are detailed in a study published in the journal Current Biology. Called the Ledumahadi Mafubi, which in the South African indigenous language of Sesotho means a giant thunderclap at dawn. The study suggests when it was alive about 200 million years ago, it was the largest land animal. According to the researchers, the dinosaur weighed about 12 metric tons and its height at its hips was about 4 meters, which was about twice the size of a large African elephant. The dinosaur remains that led to this discovery were found near Clarens in South Africa's Free State Province. Study authors say the Ledumahadi Mafubi is a close early relative to sauropod dinosaurs such as the Brontosaurus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now, remembering one of the world's really great musicians.
Well, I can't quit you, baby. But I gotta put you down for a while.
Legendary American blues guitarist Otis Rush, whose jazz-influenced sound inspired generations of musicians, has died in Chicago, Illinois. He was 84. He was suffering from complications of a 2003 stroke.
Yes, you know I love you, babe. My love for you, I can never hide. Yeah, you know I love you, baby. Well, you know you're my desire. When you hear me moaning and groaning, baby, you know it hurts me deep down inside.
Otis Rush was a key architect of the so-called Chicago West Side Sound. That was in the 1950s and 60s. His first recording in 1956, I Can't Quit You Baby, reached number 6 on the Billboard R&B chart. With qualities similar to the style of Buddy Guy, Rush influenced many musicians, including Michael Bloomfield, Peter Green, and Eric Clapton. Otis's guitars were strung with a low E string. It was at the bottom, upside down from typical guitarist. It's widely believed this contributed to his distinctive sound, like one of his fan favorites, It Takes Time, recorded in the late 1950s. Rush was inducted into the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame in 1984 and won a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Recording in 1999 for what many consider his best song ever, Any Place I'm Going.
I can't count them all. I got let them fall. Any place I'm going beats any place I've been. Any place I'm going beats any place I've been.
Otis Rush was born near Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1934 and moved to Chicago in 1948, making a name for himself playing in blues clubs on the south side and west side of the city. And in June of 2016, he made a rare appearance at the Chicago Blues Festival, where the city's mayor declared June 12th Otis Rush Day. Due to his ongoing health problems, Rush was unable to play that day, but celebrated on the sidelines with his family, who stood around him.
Any place I'm going beats any place I've been. Any place I'm going beats any place I've been. If I don't keep on moving, I'll have to do it.
I was really privileged to have the opportunity to meet Otis Rush back in the 1980s, a true gentleman, I have to say. Went on to become an elder statesman in the world of music, remarkable guitarist, amazing singer. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from the late, great Otis Rush.
I've been praying all winter just for a touch of spring. Spring, waiting for my baby and the good time she will bring. Any place I'm going beats any place I've been. Any place I'm going beats any place I've been.
This is Today in History. On October 1st, 331 BC, Alexander the Great defeated Darius III of Persia in the Battle of Gaugamela in modern-day Iran. The victory led to the end of the Persian Empire. On this day in 1946, following the Second World War, the International War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany, sentenced 12 high-ranking Nazis to death for crimes against humanity. Among the condemned was Hitler's second-in-command, Hermann Göring. The decision by Great Britain, Russia, France, and the United States to hold the trials proved influential in the development of international criminal law and the Permanent War Crimes Tribunal. On this day in 1936, during the Spanish Civil War, General Francisco Franco was named head of the rebel nationalists. It would take him more than 2 years to defeat the Republican loyalists. Following his victory, Franco served as Spain's fascist ruler for 40 years. Today is National Day in China. The PRC was founded on October 1st, 1949. On this day in 1965, the Indonesian army, led by Chief of Staff General Suharto, crushed a suspected communist coup by fellow military leaders against Indonesian President Sukarno. Suharto's ploy led to political disarray and allowed him to wrest power from Sukarno the following year. The coup attempt led to a mass anti-communist purge in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed. On this day in 1971, the Walt Disney Company opened the Magic Kingdom theme park in Orlando, Florida. Today, the park is part of the larger Walt Disney World, one of the most popular amusement parks in the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.